Judge Frisch, Judge Reyes, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 9, 2021. We are here on our third of five cases on our calendar this morning. That is A210358, State of Minnesota versus Fisher. Also, just a few housekeeping matters. Please mute your microphone if you're not speaking. The marshal will be showing a running clock of your time. You will each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'll ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jennifer Workman. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent Mr. Frederick Fisher. Your Honors, Mr. Fisher objected to the calculation of his criminal history score, specifically arguing that his federal assault conviction should only receive 1 point instead of 2. The district court chose not to address that issue and sentenced Mr. Fisher without determining the number of points he should receive. Respondent has conceded that that was an abuse of discretion. However, we differ on what the remedy should be. Mr. Fisher only challenged the weight of his that should be assigned to the federal assault conviction, not its existence. A challenge to the conviction's weight, that is how many points it should be assigned, does not require further development of the record. The record here is complete, and this court has all the information it needs to decide whether he should have been assessed 1 point or 2 points. Because of this, the proper remedy should be to reverse Mr. Fisher's 63-month sentence and remand to the district court with instructions to resentence Mr. Fisher at 3 total points. This court should not remand to the district court with instructions to give the state another opportunity to try to prove that the federal assault conviction should receive 2 points. Because the existence of that conviction is not in question, the state already had the opportunity to prove that the conviction should have 2 points and did not do so. And the Smith decision clearly dictates that that federal assault conviction should only receive 1 point. In short, there's
before you dive into the Smith case, which is non-precedential, so I appreciate that it has some similarities to this case, and you did make an interesting argument and analysis of it in your brief, but I want to shift your focus just slightly. You're right. I mean, this is an interesting case because of the state's concession that there is an error and an abuse of discretion below, which kind of does shift our analysis to what do we do on instruct on remand. But before we get there, I need to understand what exactly happened in district court. We do have cases where the district court, you know, there's no objection made. That's not your case.
Right.
No objection made. And then the district court has never decided the criminal history score issue. I mean, yes, they ostensibly decided it because there was a sentence and they relied on the PSI, but there isn't this kind of a clash that we had below. So this that does set this case a little apart. But having said that, in this case, the judge was so clear at sentencing that he was not going to exercise legal judgment on this issue because the district court believed that he was going to impose a sentence that was within the guidelines regardless of the criminal history score. Now, again, you and the state agree that that was an abuse of discretion, so I don't need to hear that. But what troubles me is we're being asked to determine a criminal history score in the first instance. And because that is a discretionary question for the district court, it's not something we would ordinarily decide in the first instance on appeal. So help me.
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First is when you look at Provost. Provost says that if the district court is clear that they were going to sentence this way anyway, an illegal sentence where the court has not taken into account the correct criminal history score needs to be reversed regardless of whether the district court was clear or not. And second, I will point you to the guidelines. The guidelines say that how you assess a criminal history score is based on the elements of the non-Minnesota offense. So when you are taking into account how to, whether you need to be the people to decide this or whether it should be the district court, I would say that it
To be fair, the guidelines are say a little bit more than the elements. They say that, you know, it, with regard to counting a non-Minnesota offense in the criminal history score depends on whether the offense is defined as a felony, gross misdemeanor, and or targeted misdemeanor in Minnesota, and the sentence imposed. As I see our record, we don't have this information.
I'm referring to 2B5B of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. And there it says it's the non-Minnesota offense when you are trying to determine the weight for it. It says it is, quote unquote, based on the elements.
Your quote's right. It's just it's not complete. You got to quote the entire passage. And it goes on to say what I just said. I'm reading it right now. So I just, you know, and I know you know these guidelines well. We just don't do that in the first instance on appeal. So
I understand.
Obstacle I think you're facing is Hill versus State, which is Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. It's been cited by the state in this case. It does suggest that the state, while analyzing a non-Minnesota conviction, definitely requires looking at the elements and the definitions of the offense and making that very legal analysis, it does also allow the district court some leeway. I don't know if that's good law, but it is Minnesota Supreme Court law and it has not been overturned.
Your Honor, if you look at the majority of the case law that is being relied upon, these are cases where the defense objected not only to the weight, but also to the existence of that conviction. And so the courts are like, you know, we need to just send this back and you decide, put in whatever evidence you need to determine if this a conviction even exists before assigning the weight. We're not there. We've already conceded that this exists. So at this point,
you know, that's a really interesting line of reasoning, counsel, that we should separate out case law depending on whether the challenge is to weight or existence. I didn't find any case law that said we should do that.
That's
a really good point you're making, but I don't see it in our case law. So
the case law would be Smith, essentially, and I understand that's non-presidential. We're in sort of a new territory here, Judge Bratbold, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate your points. However, when you take into account how the realities of how sentencing occurs and how the guidelines say that we are supposed to sentence, and everything that we have in our record here, it would be a colossal waste of time to go back and try to do this again. And I would be remiss if I did not point out that the state has already tried to do this once in another one of my clients' cases. They failed to be able to prove that this conviction was 2 points. They got it at 1 point. It does not serve the guidelines' purpose of equitable sentencing to allow my client to have 2 different points assigned for this very same conviction.
Mm-hmm. Aren't these arguments that you should be making to the district court? I mean, to Judge Bratwell's point, which I think is, it is the same point that I'm fixated on, and that is, I don't see any cases where we, as the intermediate court of appeals, are assigning criminal history or criminal history points in the first instance.
That's true, Your Honor, but this is also a novel situation.
Is it a novel situation? I mean, it does happen from time to time where criminal history scores are just accepted or they're not, disputes are not resolved. I mean, I was a district court judge for quite a while and I don't think this is so novel.
What I mean is it's novel at the appellate court level. It's not novel at the district court level where they see this type of thing all the time. Now, I will cite to you State versus Johnson, which is 411 Northwest 2nd 267. That's an opinion from this court in 1987. That goes to what the court can consider when it's trying to weigh the points and what evidence to consider. And in that case, the court said, we're not going to consider any of these kind of contradictory statements that were introduced by the appellant and by the respondent. What we're only going to consider is what the guidelines tells us to do, and they went straight to 2B5B. And so in that case, I think drawing a line here from that case, we can figure that it's fine for this court to go ahead and assign the point because you have all the information you need. You have a complete record before you. If you did not have a complete record, or if we were challenging the existence of this assault conviction, then it would be appropriate under Outlaw, under Hill.
Help me out there, counsel. Do we know what the sentence was that was imposed? Is that in the record?
Yeah.
For this federal
sentence event? Here.
Pardon me?
This is here for Mr. Fisher.
For Mr. Fisher's prior federal offense, and I can find the date. I know the date.
As far as I know, the sentence, I do not know. I can tell you, though.
I looked, because there was no certified. You are so correct about the state's burden on this, okay? The state had the burden to prove how, offer evidence as to how that prior federal offense should be scored and added to the weight. And normally it is done by a certified copy of that prior conviction and maybe some testimony even. Didn't happen here. Now, I at some point I had to ask you this. The state's attorney, the prosecuting attorney at sentencing hearing, did offer or mention to the district court, we can't really call it a motion, but mentioned,
yeah,
Judge, I'd be happy to accept a continuance today, get some more information and come back on that federal offense. The judge also did not decide that.
And right.
We didn't get a resolution. We don't decide those in the first instance either. The judge should have done. I mean, is that the abuse of discretion that the judge didn't continue sentencing?
I think certainly the judge should have done something more than he did. So, he should have taken more time. It was clear that the judge didn't even read the memorandums that were filed in this case. The judge didn't read the email from the state with their argument. The judge didn't consider any of the arguments because the judge had it in his head what he was going to do. And that is an abuse of discretion. Now, I'm not arguing that it was an abuse of discretion not to continue the sentencing hearing. I don't think that's before this court. But I believe that this court has everything that it needs to do to be able to make this decision. What you are looking at is not the sentence from the assault conviction. What you're really looking at here is the elements of the assault conviction and comparing them to the Minnesota assault statutes. And of course, Smith has already done the work for us there and said, those are not equivalent offenses. That's all you need to do in this case. And once you have done that, you can determine that this is one point. And tell the district court, okay, it should be assigned one point. And now it's in your discretion what to do with this sentence. Leave the same? Go ahead.
Yeah, but Ms. Workman, first of all, I definitely appreciate your arguments, and your prior argument that you made in terms of judicial efficiency is definitely one that came to my mind too by us making those decisions. I don't think the issue is so much whether we could make that decision, but whether we should make that decision. And all the case law, including the provost case that the state cited, seems to indicate that because we're just an error correcting court, I think you actually identified a lot of the things that the district court did not do and failed to do. And it seems like the case law really supports us as an error correcting court saying, let's send it back to the district court to get it right, to do its job, make a decision, and then if there are any issues there, it can come back on appeal. I understand that the judicial efficiency argument, but isn't this really more an issue of what is the proper role of each court and isn't it really the district court's responsibility to make that determination based on all the facts and apply the law as given?
I would say that I would agree 100% with you, Judge Reyes, if we didn't have Smith. If we didn't have the Smith decision saying, nope, this very same conviction should be 1 point, then I would say, yes, it should be sent back to determine it. But we already have the proper analysis at our fingertips here. We already have everything that needs to be done at this point.
I'm sorry to interrupt because I know you just have a few seconds left, but as Judge Bradford pointed out, Smith is a non-precedential decision, though.
That's true. It is non-precedential, but highly persuasive. And
if you find it persuasive, counsel, so the Smith decision allowed the state to supplement the record on remand. And I know you've argued about why, but it doesn't tie the Smith decision doesn't actually link that together. At least I don't see it. Maybe I missed it.
Smith, may I respond? I see that my time
is. Yes, go ahead, counsel.
Smith had a different procedural posture than we were in. The defense also challenged the existence of that federal assault conviction as opposed to just the weight, as we did. And because of that, the court sent it back to see not only, you know, what the weight is, actually what it was is that they sent it back to see, can you prove this, the existence of this assault conviction? And if you do, then it should be 1 point.
And just for the purposes of your rebuttal, here's what I'm interested in, because you argue this very eloquently in your brief, and I completely tracked your thinking on that. The part that I was missing, and I thought what Judge Reyes was getting at, but I could be wrong, is that Smith only goes so far. You know, if we agree with your view of it, it talks about where existence of the prior offense is an issue. It doesn't address this scenario. So even if it were precedential, which it isn't, it wouldn't be persuasive on this scenario. Okay. So if you don't mind, I'd love to hear that answer in your rebuttal.
All right, Ms. Workman, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Frank, go ahead, sir.
Good morning, panel. Good morning, Ms. Workman. May it please the court. My name is Dave Frank, and I am the Chief Assistant Beltrami County Attorney up here in Bemidji. There is one thing that Ms. Workman and I agree on, and that is that this case needs to be remanded for resentencing based upon an abuse of discretion at the district court. I would echo Ms. Workman that we disagree on how we get there. The appellants claim that the court adopted the worksheet through assigning 2 points for the federal assault conviction is not supported in the sentencing transcript. The transcript makes clear that the district court consciously chose not to decide whether the prior federal conviction for the felony assault resulting in serious bodily harm was equal to the Minnesota offense of first degree assault. The court's rationale that the decision was, and I'm paraphrasing, academic in light of the 63-month sentence, falling within both the range of a criminal history score of 3 and a criminal history score of 4, may have some surface appeal, but it's dead wrong under the law. And I would cite to State versus Provost. An offender's criminal history score is never an academic exercise. It's a requirement to arrive at an accurate and therefore legal sentence. That was not done here by the district court. And as a result,
counsel, I think we are with you on that. And the appellant's counsel is as well. We've got that far through the analysis. I am struggling with what to do on remand. And you heard the discussion that we had with appellant's counsel on it. You're going to have to convince me that this should be remanded. I did ask questions that suggest why it should be remanded, but it does go the other way. So this court does have many cases, not that I could find. I found a couple in the sentencing context where this court reaches legal determinations about criminal history scores on appeal. And I think that's the argument I am hearing from the appellant, is that this is a legal determination about the elements of the federal offense versus the elements of whatever it's assault one apparently would be the most applicable Minnesota offense. And that's a pretty straightforward analysis. You look at U.S. Supreme Court case law, that's what they do. They compare the elements and we're done. That's a legal analysis. There are several Court of Appeals decisions that do that kind of analysis on appeal. Why shouldn't we go ahead, even though it wasn't decided by the district court?
Because of Hill versus State, Your Honor.
Okay, I'm troubled. You heard me. I'm troubled by Hill versus State. Hill versus State pulls the quote that you rely on, and I can, you know, refer to it specifically. The quote from Hill versus State is about the district court considering the nature and definition of the foreign offense, as well as the sentence received. And that was at a time where that language in that format was in the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. The language is now different. It's what I quoted earlier to your opposing counsel. It's changed. So how valid is Hill versus State? I mean, it relied on Minnesota sentencing guidelines that are no longer there.
It is precedent. It was cited by this court in the Smith case, which is one of the foundations of Ms. Workman's argument. Hill is still good law. If it is good law, this court is obligated to follow that precedent. Also respond to Judge Bradfold's response, Hill is still good law. It's still followed in the district court. It was followed by the Minnesota Supreme Court in State versus Reese in 2001. You can't just use a word-for-word comparison between the federal and state statutory definitions. You have to determine if the conduct involved in the federal offense matches an offense description in a state statute. That is still good law.
So, counsel, let me just stop you there. You say that the district court should be allowed to look at Mr. Fisher's conduct in this federal offense and deciding what weight? So that I see nature of the offense in Hill versus State. I don't see what you just said, his conduct. I mean, you could argue it falls under that, but it's not specifically mentioned, I don't think. And I really don't see that in the current sentencing guidelines.
And this was an issue in Smith to remand it back to the district court in order to determine whether the not just the offense definition, but the conduct itself, whether that would qualify as a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony level sentence under Minnesota law. So it's conduct that the court still has to apply. The Minnesota Supreme Court ruling has not changed that.
So let me take you in just a slightly different direction, as I appreciate, I think, your position on this. So this was a challenge that the criminal history score was challenged by Mr. Fisher twice during these proceedings. Happened by motion that never got heard until the sentencing hearing. And then it happened again at the sentencing hearing. Clear objection and very clear statement as to how this federal offense should be factored into his criminal history score. Nobody's questioning that whether he preserved the issue. So the state was completely on notice about this issue. The only thing the state did was apparently send some kind of email reference that we don't have. Again, citing Hill versus State, that's about all you did. There was never any effort by the state to do the standard things, which is file a certified copy of the transcript of conviction or some other evidence that goes to these points that you're talking about. So didn't the state forfeit its opportunity to do that?
I would say no, Your Honor, because I wanted to address this, as the court can see in the sentencing transcript, and the court had made its determination. Whether it's a 3 or a 4 is academic. From the district court's perspective, a 63-month sentence is the issue governing here. And the court didn't find it very important to determine whether it was to be a severity level 1 or whether it was to be scored at a 1 based upon the sentencing guidelines or at a 2. I simply relied on Hill versus State. I wasn't allowed to develop record. at the sentencing hearing in terms
I'm troubled when you say that, Mr. I'm sorry, I am, when you say you're not allowed to develop the record. I mean, this is the strange case where we've got Mr. Fisher absconding for this long period of time. That motion was actually his motion to correct his criminal history score had been filed a long time ago. Clearly, the attorney at the hearing, and perhaps it was you, and I forgot that, knew that that motion had been filed and you had read it. I mean, it falls to the state to offer that evidence at the sentencing hearing. And that's what prosecuting attorneys generally do.
And admittedly, Judge Bradfold, I did not do that. And that was not incorporated into the record. I acknowledge that. But it's still up to the district court to make that appropriate decision. That's what I was trying to get to at the sentencing hearing, but the court took it in a different direction. And I think the court also alluded to the complicated procedural posture at the district court level. This case starts out in 2017 with a felony DWI charge. The case gets addressed in 2018. As the court can see from the transcripts, it was a negotiated plea agreement with the court expecting the appellant to complete chemical dependency treatment and aftercare. The appellant does not do that. That shifts the court's focus to, well, he had his opportunity to show that he was amenable. He failed to do that. So the court then emails and notifies the parties of his decision to not grant the departure. Defendant gets inadvertently released from the Beltrami County Jail, does not show up, does not stay in contact with counsel. A year and a half afterwards, the case gets readdressed when the defendant gets taken into custody. The defendant has new counsel. It's a very complicated history. And then the focus when he gets taken back into custody isn't necessarily sentencing immediately. It's motion to withdraw the guilty plea, motion to have the assigned judge removed. I don't have any problem with the way that was handled, but I'm just explaining to the court that it was a very, very complicated history. Not going to make an excuse. I should have filed these documents. And when we finally got to sentencing, I made an effort to see if the court would allow me to proceed. The court's decision, the court's mind was made up. The court wanted to take this in a different direction, focusing on the number of months that he thought that the defendant should serve, and not accurately determining his criminal history score. The district court can get messy, and this is an example of it.
Yeah, one more question for you. So I want to make sure I understand your thoughts on the importance of judicial efficiency, economy, and the equitable concerns of remanding in this scenario. Help me out with that. I understand the jurisprudential reasons why our court does not decide issues like this in the first instance. It is the general rule, but we make exceptions where issues involving equity or judicial economy are at play. So help me understand how we should evaluate that here.
I've got a simple response, Judge Bradfold, because it's important to get it right. And when the court applies Hill versus State, the main focus should be on the offense definitions. The sentencing court should also consider the nature of the offense and the sentence received by the offender. The offender was sentenced to 78 months in this case. That's a significant sentence. And the court needs to take that into account in addition to the conduct at issue. The court needs to get it right, and the court needs more information. It would not be just for this court to simply rely on the record as it exists right now. Look at what the Minnesota Supreme Court did in State versus Reese. It's not an identical situation, but the district court failed to address the nature of the Texas convictions as it affected the defendant's criminal history score. The defendant made an objection, just like Mr. Fisher did here, but the court didn't adequately address it in Reese. The Minnesota Supreme Court remanded it back in order for this court to get it right by taking that conduct into account. And that's important here too. Consider the policy discussion in Hill versus State. Mr. Fisher's circumstances aren't also at play. It's also other defendants who have similar criminal history. Mr. Fisher shouldn't benefit from the court not taking proper consideration under Hill versus State and avoid a criminal history score that he may be required to. And I'll be the first to state, if we get that conduct and it looks more like substantial bodily harm as opposed to great bodily harm, he should get a criminal history score of 1. But we need that information in order to get it right. And that's why this court should send it back to the district court, not make a decision based upon the record, as it says. The record is deficient, and we need to get it right.
Anything else from the panel? Or Mr. Frank, anything else in your remaining time?
No, I would, unless the panel has any other questions, I would yield the balance of my time to Ms. Work.
All right, thank you. Anything else from the panel? Doesn't appear so. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Workman.
Can you hear me? Okay. Judge Bradfield, you wanted me to address Smith and its persuasiveness and why it should apply here. And I've given that some thought, and I would point to you to the part of Smith that says that at the end, it's if the state can prove the existence of this assault conviction, because remember that they had also challenged the existence in that case, then the district court has to give him 1 point, because they had already determined that it should be 1 point. So that is very persuasive in this instance, because that's where we are at this point. I would also point you to Mathis, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case that is cited in my brief. And in that case, as you rightly pointed out, how they do it in federal court, they make the determination based on the elements and then tell the district court how to resentence. There's nothing in our case law saying that you cannot do that. And I think Mathis sets a good precedent for us in that field. Regarding the conduct argument that Mr. Frank is making, I just respectfully say that you should disagree and disregard that argument, because that is not the language of the current guidelines. I'm not sure what year Reese is from, but that's sure. I'm not sure if it predates our current guidelines, but it's not. It does not reflect what this court is supposed to take into account when you're assigning weights to out of the state and out of jurisdiction convictions. And I just want to make the point that we're not budging in here on the trial court's discretion. The trial court still retains a lot of discretion in this case. The trial court gets to ultimately decide what the sentence should be. But the only thing that we're telling the trial court to do is give him 1 point instead of 2. And that's it. It's not a big ask in this case. And there's certainly under judicial economy, under equitable principles, under Smith, under Mathis, there's purposes for doing this. And in this case, it does not make sense to try to give them almost a third bite at the apple at this point. And so because of that, Your Honors, I think you're well positioned because of the record that you have before you, because of how the guidelines are written, and because of Smith, Mathis, even Outlaw, you have the power to go ahead and tell the court just to sign 1 point, but the ultimate final decision on the sentence is up to you.
Ms. Workman, I do appreciate the argument of we potentially have the power to do it, but I'm still concerned about whether or not we should be exercising that discretion. The Supreme Court, Minnesota Supreme Court, has noted on several times and slapped our hand for overstepping our authority as an error-correcting court, and noting that if it's an issue that the district court should decide as a court of first impression, we should let them. Everybody's in agreement, and certainly appreciate the state's agreement that there is an error here, and so it has to be reversed. If it's going to be reversed anyway and a different sentence imposed, why shouldn't we remand it for the district court to get it right and actually do undertake the steps that it should have done in the first instance?
The getting right part is correcting the error that occurred. And the error that occurred here is not assigning the correct weight to this conviction. And so what I'm asking of you to do is actually perfectly in line with what your providence is. And that is to tell the court, hey, you get to sentence this person, but we get to tell you that the law says we're making a legal determination. The law says that when you have this very same conviction, it is not equivalent to a Minnesota offense, and therefore it should only receive 1 point. I have no other comments or remarks to make. Are there any other questions from the court?
Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you very much, counsel. Arguments were very helpful today. Thank you very much. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time period.